Welcome to the Calgary Sessions. This is episode number 57. I'm your host, Jeff Humphreys. Today's guest, I always say this. I say this almost because everyone that sits down here is really, really cool. So I think this is going to be a fascinating conversation. I know just a little bit about your background from Shane. And I was like, holy hell. So anyways, this is going to be a fun one. So please introduce yourself, name, and who you are.
Thank you, Jeff. I'm Lara Smith. Calgarian, business owner, mom. Those are the highlights.
Born and raised in Calgary?
No, born and raised in Edmonton. I know that's going to be a whole Oilers Flames.
Yeah, is it a thing?
Oh, 100%.
Are you still an Oilers fan?
Yes. Okay. We have to stop the conversation right now.
Oh my God.
I grew up in the heyday of Gretzky, era, five cups. Yep. It is in me. It is in my blood. Mm. Yes.
And when did you move to Calgary then?
So I had a stint in Toronto after university, economics major. Mm-hmm. I left for the big city and promises of career. I wanted to be in head offices buying. So I left Edmonton, moved to Toronto right after university and had a 15-year career there.
Yeah.
And then landed back in Alberta, Alberta's home.
Perfect.
Yeah.
How'd you get into hockey? Was your family just diehard Oilers fans? Was it the only option?
No, this is so weird. Of course, Edmonton's a small town, and it was so exciting when Gretzky came and the team got a little bit interesting. But I am a data stats freak. So I started going with my dad because I loved understanding hockey stats.
No way.
And so it wasn't as much as, I mean, we loved the hockey. It was exciting times, all that through the cups. But I just loved understanding goals against and stats and who's on the ice and why and the science behind. Mm. How weird.
Mm-hmm. But were you writing, physically writing down things?
For sure. My dad had to buy me a program every time because I would get the updated stats before the world of, all the things you can see online. So it was, paper stats. I'd compare week to week.
No way.
I don't think I've ever told anyone that story.
Crazy. And you were young.
I was, 11.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wild.
So here we go.
If we've started. Okay, we're over the Oilers thing. You and I are good. So the gist of the show is I like the guests to go back, and you just did. Go back to a point where you kind of start remembering things, when things started clicking or what you're interested in as a kid. Mm-hmm. We know where you grew up, but how you grew up, and then we'll kind of weave our way to the business side of you that you're up to right now. So yeah, take it back to as far as you want to go.
There is a theme and a pattern about what I was drawn to as an adolescent in high school, university was – why and how people were attracted to what they bought and how they thought about purchasing, even before it was a conversation. That was just kind of inside my psychology. And in university, in economics, trying to figure out what I wanted to do, I was trying to connect business finance around. I also worked through university at Ralph Lauren, and it blew my mind in Edmonton how people would go in and spend $125 on a cotton polo shirt that messed with me. Mm-hmm. And then I'm in economics and I'm like, I have to figure out how and why people do this and how Ralph Lauren was this massive lifestyle brand with overpriced products, but people were beyond loyal to these brands. And it was like, no, there's something in that for me as a career. And so working in Ralph Lauren in Edmonton, I moved to Toronto after university and my first job was the Gucci head office on the Gucci sales floor, Bloor Street, the most expensive sales per foot luxury retail in the country. Like a turnip right off the turnip truck from Edmonton. I showed up for my interview and I had to hide my U of A sweatshirt. I was Levi's and sweatshirt girl showing up for a Gucci interview. It was I don't even know how they gave me the job.
And you just did your own thing. You're just being you and that's how you showed up. Were you into fashion back then? I want you to go further back. Can you go back to growing up in Edmonton and what was interesting? What were you doing? Yeah. Junior high, high school. What were you were you doing sports? Were you looking at industries and figuring things out? You're looking at stats, but were there other things that were grabbing your attention?
Yes, it was. I was a competitive tennis player. So I was a total, and I didn't go to high school dances. I was always in tournaments or playing tennis. High school was a means to an end. I was very drawn to politics. So no matter who came to town, regardless of a liberal conservative, if someone came to town, I would either drag myself to a political breakfast at downtown Eaton Center or whatever from the time I was 15. So
where did that come from?
very wise, dialed in parents who read three papers a day, and Saturday, Sunday breakfasts were, okay, girls, family of three daughters, reading the newspaper and talking about politics, business, the world events every weekend.
No way.
It was in me very young.
Hmm. And put that beside very competitive tennis?
Very competitive tennis.
So was everything dialed up growing up? Like, was everything like very focused, kind of all in, driven? What was it?
No, it's so interesting. We had such a casual upbringing, and I wish I could go back and put in a bottle how my parents cultivated our family and my sisters and our upbringing, because my one sister was a professional squash player, won the nationals twice. The other, like, just, but it was zero pressure. It's like, girls, do the things that you'd like to do. You're getting an education. You're going to be dialed in. Mm-hmm. They taught values on the golden rule was the only thing I really remember as like very important growing up. But it was, we did what we wanted to do, and there must have been some culture that we wanted to excel at whatever we tried, but it wasn't forced or pressured or focused at all.
When you say you're trying to, like, do you give it much thought trying to figure out how they pulled that off? And because you're now mother.
Yes.
Is it, you know, no, you can't really replicate things or do the exact same thing, but it's interesting, I'm sure, to think back and wonder how they, like, how does that happen? Like, are all three of you high performers?
For sure. Like, my younger sister is now the number one tennis player in Alberta. My other sister runs a hugely successful million-dollar business that she created out of nothing. No, it's I analyze it. Sometimes we talk about it, but it's just such a unique recipe of whatever they did.
Mm-hmm. So you guys were just, you could kind of do what you wanted to. School is always like a priority all the time, but you could kind of test sports, test things, and see what you're interested in.
Try whatever you want. But at certain stage, you're going to have to let go of a few things to try to do something and just focus on that. And so all of us got to pick what we wanted to do.
Yep.
And then we were just very well supported, very well loved. We always felt like we could do anything we put our mind to it. And that's the culture of growing up in my house.
Yeah. And obviously that kind of, to have that kind of foundation helps you kind of pull off what you've pulled off over the last X amount of years.
Just
having that. Is it just like self-confidence and knowing that you can, if you put your mind to something, you can pull it off? Or is it this, you need the skill plus the passion? Like, what are you learning back then, do you think?
I mean, self-confidence, we were allowed to fail. It was no, we wouldn't get in trouble for trying something and screwing it up. Yeah. So there was this innate self-worth, self-confidence. Part of the recipe is having a brilliant father in finance. Mm. Who worshipped my mom, and she was brilliant, and she chose to stay home. And it was in an era where women did stay home, but she had a big career before she got married. And we were taught the value of ensuring as women that we never – I don't want to come off as a pedantic feminist now, but you guys can take care of yourselves. No matter what happens, you will not need a husband if you want.
Mm-hmm.
But very loving, supportive, amazing – parents that loved and respected each other. That had to be the foundation of what we saw every day.
And do you ever get, do you give that much thought ever?
Now that we're talking about it,
I know. Before you and I sat down, like, does this ever creep into conversations or into your?
Every now and then when someone meets my family or my extended family of cousins and they're all just crazy off the charts, successful, it's like, what the hell was with your family? Like, I don't know. I don't really know. And then we would talk about it for a bit, and it all just came down to just my parents' values.
Yeah.
Be a good person, work hard, be nice to people.
It'd be like basics, right?
Basics.
How did those get lost, or where did those get lost on most
Somewhere
people?
Somewhere they did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The tennis is interesting to me. Where did that take you?
Nationals, competing nationally, top whatever in Alberta as a teenager. Mm-hmm. Loved it. Mm-hmm. Coached. I got my coaching certificate through all of that as in university, so I could do that part-time.
Oh, cool.
A little Ralph Lauren and a little tennis coaching. And it's a great game, and it was just something that I loved to do, and it was good money part-time.
Yep. Your business background is kind of insane. Like I said, I only know a little bit about it. So, let's go back to the Gucci interview. I'm curious. I'm really curious about your path because what you've, you know, where you worked and what you were doing and obviously what you're doing right now too. So yeah, go back to Gucci.
I knew enough at the time at a young age to keep my mouth shut and let my experience speak for me and really listen to what they wanted at Gucci because I worked at Ralph Lauren. I worked at the only freestanding Ralph Lauren store at West Edmonton Mall, and that I did a decent job in sales and customer service, and I just had my resume and I was polite and they told me what they wanted. And I did find – I borrowed an outfit for the interview because – Holt Renfrew, that culture of how you look, what you wear, the mascara, the shoes, the whole thing mm-hmm. is a real thing. And even when I interviewed, I knew enough to just, I'm going to have to dial up my game fast. But because I had experience, they gave me a shot.
Yep.
And that was it. And then you have to prove yourself.
And like salesperson on the floor?
Salesperson on the floor. Like, that's how it started.
That's where you worked in Edmonton at Ralph Lauren doing that?
Yes.
And then went out east and then?
Yes. And then I got the benefit, the buyer for Canada was my boss, so he worked on the floor, and he bought all of what Holt Renfrew Gucci assortment looked like, mm-hmm. and he outfitted some of the most powerful, wealthy women and housewives in Toronto.
They would come, they would like literally come through the store?
They would walk in the store. My favorite story is this really wealthy billionaire wife came in and literally snapped her fingers. It was like, Lara, I am having lunch with three women at the cafe at Holt Renfrew. And it's horrifying how they're dressed. Can you just pick out some Gucci scarves for them? I'm taking them back up so at least they can. At the time, they're $300 silk scarves. And it blew me away every day how much money people spent on this stuff.
And when you say that, like, I'm guessing you didn't grow up like that.
No.
I'm guessing you didn't have the money to go buy $300. So you're in this world with these wild people.
Yes.
How are you dealing with it?
As you say that, now I'm reflecting back. We had a beautiful private tennis club that we belonged to. And one day I came home and I said, Mom, all my friends are wearing these Ralph Lauren tennis shirts. There is zero chance, Lara, you're ever getting a Ralph Lauren shirt to play tennis in. Off we go to Lady Foot Locker for your $11 mm-hmm. tennis shirts. And it was just like shut down so fast. Thank God that wasn't in me. Because then the world I moved to Toronto. Mm-hmm. Again, values-based, I was obsessed with fabrics and value, and I was always drawn to what would make a $1,000 loafer and what goes into that make it $1,000 and what makes people the psychology of wanting to buy that and what do they need in their life that they have to buy mm-hmm. a $1,000 Gucci loafer.
And did you go to school to get those answers, or was it kind of like school and then work experience?
Because I was economics, it was supply and demand, like just mm-hmm. foundational economics. If someone wants to buy that, there's a demand for it.
Yep.
But why? Like, why makes them want to buy that thing on that day?
So when you're, this is like fascinating to me because this is like the why drives mm-hmm. everything.
That's right.
And when you're working on the floor there and these people are buying these wild things.
Yeah.
And you're just, you know, you're doing a good job, you're taking care of them, but are you also like processing a bunch of things? Like who this person is, where they work, how they got here. And then you're trying to figure out, again, why is the shoe made like this and all these things? Is this like every day?
So many things. And what I learned at the time, the wealthy customers coming in, for the most part, were the most gracious, kind, generous, down-to-earth people. Hmm. The people that I worked with at Holt Renfrew on the sales floor that were in so much debt to buy whatever at their 50% discount to look cool at the club that weekend mm-hmm. were horrible. Mm-hmm. It's like, wow, this is so interesting. I mean, I wouldn't have thought the things you learn about psychology and human nature in an environment like that at my age mm-hmm. was just.
How old are you ish?
22.
Okay. So pretty young.
Yes. Dealing
with some influential big movers.
Crazy. And the owner of Holt Renfrew, Hillary Weston, would walk in. Lovely, gracious person. Mm-hmm. And what I realize is when you're nice and genuine with people, whether they're billionaires, the owner of Holt's, whoever, customers that come in, that serves you well.
Yeah.
Just listen to them. You don't have to be douchey. You don't have to be flashy. If you're just genuine and listen mm-hmm. to people, mm-hmm. you find out what they need.
Mm-hmm. But it's that art of listening.
That is a skill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I think, well, nobody ever talks about that. Like, how do you... I don't think you can learn how to do that. I think it's just something you have.
My grandfather owned a hardware store in Edmonton, and my dad worked for his store. So what he was taught who taught us, when someone comes into the hardware store looking for a quarter-inch drill, that's not what they want. They want to drill a quarter-inch hole in a wall. So you find out what that is. You mm-hmm. don't just sell them anything. Like, what's the emotional insight behind why they need something or want something? And that mm-hmm. was – that's one of the single biggest thing to my entire career.
Mm-hmm. You've gone back to it. Like,
oh.
Like, it's just this yes. constant theme.
That's right.
So what happens after that? How long are you there for? Are you graduated? Are you working there while you're going to school?
No, I graduated at U of A and then I moved to Toronto that. So yeah, so it was a couple of years at Gucci, and my roommate won this all-inclusive Gucci by putting in a draw at our Gucci event. She won a trip to Rome, this huge five-star trip, and she wanted to take me. But because I was an employee at Holt Renfrew and Gucci, I couldn't go. So I quit that day. So I could go to...
No way.
Well, wouldn't everybody? I'm freaking 20, by that point, 23 years old.
Yeah.
I'm going to Italy. Mm-hmm. We were eating like KD every week to make it go a couple meals. So yeah. This is our shot.
Gone. So what happened on the trip? Was it straight enjoyment or were you...
Pure enjoyment. Yeah. Pure fun.
But you remember this. This is like a moment in time. Like
oh,
when
yeah.
you quit and go away.
I learned it with choices.
Yeah.
And live with your choices. I knew I had a decent job, but I didn't like sales. I wanted to get into back office, buying, sourcing, over the business side of fashion. I didn't want to be in sales. So it was just, yeah. it happened at the right time that I could have this great opportunity,
yeah.
come back and then get a real job.
Which was what?
I became an assistant buyer.
Okay.
In the world of like big head office retailing. And that evolved to be a buyer at Eaton's. You're barely old enough to remember. Do you remember?
Eaton Center?
Eaton Center.
Oh, yeah, totally.
That's where I worked in Toronto.
Yep.
And loved it because that's when I started traveling and I could travel overseas and meeting with suppliers. And they gave me a $25 million budget to fill with buying stuff, designer brands, private label. And that was like really my first important job in the world of buying and fashion.
And you, when did you kind of know that you wanted to be on that side of things?
Because that's where you can build a brand. That's truly where you can sell, you can learn.
Yeah.
But building a brand starts when you think about I want to create something. How do you go do it? Mm-hmm. And why do you want to do it? And who's it going to target? That's in the world of buying and sourcing.
And that's what really got you.
Oh yeah, always.
Mm. And so when you have a giant budget like that to go fill,
mm-hmm.
how do you decide? How do you decide what you're going to pull off? Like, how many brands can you bring in? Are you thinking about how many I can bring in under 25 mil? Like how many I have 8 different brands and that kind of gets me to my number?
Remember, I'm a person that loves data, like mm-hmm. Oilers,
mm-hmm.
hockey
mm-hmm.
stats.
Mm-hmm.
It's art and science. It's like, what's the history of what worked and why? Going to talk to customers on the floor, I would travel across the country and go to different Eaton stores and people, like, what are people looking for?
Mm-hmm.
So you're looking at what sells, why,
yep.
has to be profitable. And what's coming down the pipeline, because you're just personal shoppers for the future customer, anticipating what they need. So there's a lot of risk,
yep.
but I'm a bit of a gambler, obviously. So I would just kind of figure out what I needed to keep from past seasons and what would be new to inspire. And you get into patterns with each season, you get yep. smarter. But it was irresponsible of them to give me such a big budget at such a young age. So I made a lot of mistakes.
And why did they give you a crack? What was it about you that you think had that they bought in?
I always over-prepared at that point for interviews. Mm-hmm. I would do so much research on what were they selling? What were their competitors selling? Why? Trying to find out what they were successful at. So I would be very prepared in mm-hmm. understanding and where I could add value. Listen, this is what I'm seeing in my opinion, using my humble kind of Edmonton roots. This is what I think might be an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just think they figured, like, what do we have to lose? And then just, there's no shortcut to hard work too. Like that's yeah. one of the secrets in business. You do have to work hard at certain stages of your career.
Mm-hmm. The other interesting thing you said was the brand piece.
Mm-hmm.
Like your understanding of a brand. Where does that mm-hmm. come from? Because you said it so like perfectly right now.
Yeah.
And there's the vast majority of people that don't understand brand the way you just said it. When did the lights come on around brand? When did you figure out what it truly means?
Well, there was something for sure going on when I worked at Ralph Lauren because it was the loyalty of the loyalty and the price of Ralph Lauren and understanding what a global brand it was, that came from somewhere in-house. So I'd buy a lot of books. Mm-hmm. Same with Gucci. What made that such a coveted, special luxury brand?
Did you learn? Like, did you figure it out?
Yeah. God, who figures it out?
Well, I think you've...
My gosh.
Well, I think you've made some really good decisions because I think you know a lot about it.
There's luck too. That's a different part of the conversation. Yeah. But I think there was a business book that came along at the right time, A New Brand World by Scott Bedbury. And he was the chief marketing officer for Nike and Starbucks 25 years ago.
I have to clip this so I remember it.
It's really good.
Yeah. Okay. Still in today's...
Absolutely. Okay. Because it does delve in the early days. He was one of the first guys that talked about building the emotional connection around the experience. It was never about the thing, the coffee. It was the story, all the things you talk about, the story of how they source the coffee, building these environments of these Starbucks locations that people wanted to come and sit there with their laptop and spend $6 on a coffee. Like, it was unheard of. And he sounded like a crazy person when he was at these companies, Nike and Starbucks. Mm-hmm. But it came down to the intangibles of a brand and building the emotional connection that made people want to keep coming back and back and being consistent in the experience. So that kind of shaped me.
Hmm. I just stuck.
Oh, for sure. To this day, yeah.
But isn't it – I find it very interesting that – most people just can't wrap their head around that idea. They're very driven around the product, you know, like this. No. I sell this, and this is all I have to talk about. This is all I can. This is my only thing. But there's just the brand level is a totally different discussion.
It's a different discussion, and I look back at the thread of my career and these really pivotal points that have shaped me. And when I was a buyer at Eaton's, the Eaton's family insisted that all head office worked on the sales floor at Christmas time. And this distraught woman came into my department because I was at the Eaton Center. I was in the fancy dress department at the time one night, and she came in. She just looked at me and she's like, I need a party dress. And not the most pleasant woman. I'm like, excellent. What's the event? What do you like? And then she just starts bawling. She just got dumped right before her company Christmas party. She thought this was going to be the man that she was going to spend the rest of her life with. Crying, I just don't even know, but if you can help me, I just need to make an appearance at this thing. We found a dress not in the right color. Her party was the next day. I'm like, this is your dress. This looks amazing on you. And she came out of the fitting room and you just saw her whole physiology changed about how happy she was that someone took the time. She was going to feel good. She was going to look good at this party, but it wasn't the right color. And I just said, I'm getting you the right color. It's at the shirtwaist store. I'm going to drive there. I'm going to come to your apartment in the morning. You're going to have this dress. My buddy in shoes is going to like get over here right now. I'm making calls. And so I see her the next day. I drop off the dress. I don't know anything about who this woman was. She is writing letters to Thor Eaton about I'm going to sound like an idiot,
no,
but
not.
It was like
you're not.
I might have committed suicide that weekend. I was so depressed. And this Yahoo blonde in the dress department she found me this. She went out of her way, and it changed my whole view of Christmas parties, my idiot ex-boyfriend. And I was like, a dress has the power to do that? Ooh, women's psychological insights on what make them feel good and happy and feel great about themselves. That's my career.
Hmm. Right there.
Oh, for sure.
It's just like smacked. You're just like, this is it.
I can help women. And then it became waking up in service of women every day. How can I help them feel better about themselves? Every woman, I don't care, Victoria's Secret model, they have some level of insecurity about something. And that became Marks. Who's going to want to grow women's business inside a hard hat environment? So
before we go there.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
Because I wanted to get there. Okay. So here we are.
Yeah.
So once you realize that, is the clock on then at Eaton's? You're like, okay, I'm running out of runway here. There's something else I need to do.
Eventually. It's just these building blocks, right?
Yeah.
Because when I moved on to another kind of big job at this Northern Reflections that sells bunnies on sweatshirts, a $1 billion company. That became my last corporate job. $1 billion company in Toronto.
Northern Reflections.
I know.
Wild.
Loons and bunnies. That's not Gucci or Ralph Lauren. Mm-hmm. So you have to disconnect your personal taste from what you're the customer you're serving.
Yep.
Because that's a whole different psychology of customer to Gucci, billion-dollar company also. Mm-hmm. But that's when Marks came calling, when I was VP running that.
Did you, before we go there, I'm holding off on the Marks thing. the corporate world was always something you want to be a part of. You said it a little, like,
for learning.
Yeah. And climbing the ladder and dealing with all the red tape and all the politics and all the shit. Like, that was, you were okay with all that?
I had to be, because I was going to learn from the smartest people who ran big companies.
And did you know, did you know that you were going to do your own thing eventually?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So that's it.
Oh, yes.
Okay. So that's at the...
Not an active thought, but deep in my subconscious, yeah.
And just because when you're working these places and you're seeing either leaders making decisions, or you're seeing opportunities that aren't being filled, you're like, okay, I'm putting things together that I can come up with an idea that can do something for women?
Yes. It really clicked with that customer at Eaton's.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. Marks Work Warehouse.
So I get the call.
So P.S. So you're the VP of what at Northern Reflections?
VP of buying.
Okay.
Which is P&L.
Right?
Yeah. You're managing the P&L, because when you're the merchant, the chief merchant, doing all the product, you deliver the gross margin of the company based on what you buy, sell, plan, the assortment, develop, which allows the company to run and pay everything. So it's a big job, the chief merchant job, and that's what I was doing in Toronto at the end before Marks came.
But it fit, right? Like, just because you're analytical, stats, numbers.
Analytical, anticipating people's needs, making them feel good with clothing.
Dangerous, right?
Dangerous.
To have the numbers behind you to make the good decisions and understand why people want things.
It all comes together really nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you, Marks finds you, or how does this happen?
Marks recruited me in Toronto.
Okay.
I was newly pregnant with my second son, and I was honest. I'm like, I'm pregnant. I'm not making a move. My young family is very established. And they kind of kept calling. I agreed to meet with them. The CEO at the time, who was growing Marks, brilliant entrepreneurial guy. And I said, sorry, no offense. You're a bunch of men putting hard hats and work boots in a store. That's really great. I understand that business.
Yeah.
You don't need me for anything. It's like, no, Lara, women are in our stores buying for these guys, buying their hard hats. Women are in the stores, and we have 300 of them. We want to build something here in women's, so let's go have some fun. And they're entrepreneurial enough, the opposite of corporate, zero red tape,
which
nimble.
At 300 stores, that seems like a unique group.
It was very unique at the time. There was a few people. You could make the decisions and act really quickly, which was appealing. And he said, you have full autonomy to build the strategic plan, hire whoever you want. You can completely, we will stay out of your hair. Check. That's a feeling. Right?
Yeah.
It was not as, Eaton's was very corporate. Northern was very corporate. You had to get a meeting together of 22 people to make a decision to change a sign in two stores. Like,
So he was saying the right thing.
He was saying the right things at the right time.
Yeah.
So I moved, 7 months pregnant. I started a new job, moved my husband and son and my pregnant self to Calgary in 2004 and got after it.
So what does that actually mean? And, you know, everybody knows Marks, obviously.
Yeah.
And now that I think about it, you know, walking in, the closest one to me is in West Hills.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember walking in there, and I don't think there was like a huge women's section for sure. Like, it was never... You never really thought about Marks and women.
No.
It was just like boots and vests and hats and gloves and socks.
Yes.
So you take the job, and what's your, are you nervous?
No.
No? Because you knew exactly what you were going to do?
No, I never know what I'm going to do. But that's where I go figure it out. That's where data and talking to people.
Yep.
And I had enough patterns by this time in my career. So I land in Calgary. I spend most of the first year talking to as many Marks store associates and customers as I could.
Yep.
I developed a little informal customer advisory group with my team that I was building in Calgary. And we would talk to these women every couple of weeks and say, and the theme was, what pisses you off the most about apparel, footwear, outerwear? And it always, like you talking to people, it always goes somewhere. I have CAD kids. I can't get rid of the muffin top. My maturing body sucks. I don't have time. It's about everyone else in the house. I don't have time to work out. and I have 15 extra pounds and I hate my body. Oh, we can help you with that. Mm. So we take these psychological and emotional insights. My sourcing team and I land in Asia.
Yeah.
And we start engineering panels in pants.
This is awesome.
Because it's like everyone's, well, what are you wearing for that?
Yeah.
Well, I really want to wear track pants, but I have to wear, I'm a bank teller. I have to wear dress pants. I hate it.
Yeah.
And we spend days in factories and textile mills re-engineering panels and waistbands. It's like we have an idea. And there's always some brilliant technician pattern maker that's like, oh, that's cool. Mm. And then they come up with an idea. You go back to your hotel at 10 the next – and then you come back the next morning and they've got a new prototype. And they brought in a larger model for us to see it on. And it's minimizing her muffin top. And we add panels to flatten her stomach and lift her bum. And it, and then the real kind of fun happened at Mark's when we launched our perfect this new pant program that made you look slimmer, hid your muffin top. And we called it, like, quietly, it was like getting $10,000 of plastic surgery in a $50 pant. Mm. And women went bananas.
Crazy.
Because it actually worked.
Yep.
And we could mark it in our flyers. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the beginning of what problem can we solve next?
So crazy. I don't even know where to go. Going to Asia and working with the manufacturers. Mm-hmm. Had you done that before?
A little bit.
And were you confident enough, or did you have a team with you that, you know, when you're looking at patterns, you're talking about sizing and how things fit and ideas? Did you have all that in your bag of tricks, or were you?
There was always people with me, or people. We worked with big factories that had teams of technicians and pattern makers. But I always brought it back to how it would help the consumer.
Yeah.
So the technical part, people would try and get me into. It's like, no, I'm representing our customer, Simone, whoever she was. We had like different personas, and she's got extra weight, and she wants to look slimmer, and she wants to feel better about herself.
Yep.
Go figure out how to make that happen. And then we would just see the process happen at the factory until we had a perfect prototype. Then we'd take these prototypes back to Calgary, have our customer advisory panel. It's like, ladies, try these on. What? Oh, my God. When did we get them? How did we get them?
Did you ever record those?
No.
Imagine recording those, right? If social was a thing back then?
Oh, my gosh, right?
It would be crazy.
UGC or whatever it's called?
Yeah.
And that is where we got the confidence based on the reaction. And sometimes they would say, well, that's a dumb idea. Why'd you put a pocket there? Factory, take off the pocket.
Yeah.
Put 100,000 units into production.
Go.
So that's just the entire thing. There's a million programs like that that we executed.
And to launch that within a super male-centric brand, how do you even bridge that? How do you even bring it in, you know, besides allocating square footage in a building to put stuff in there? How do you start changing like the actual marketing of it?
It's funny how sales and revenue drive the world, because I would quietly put these programs in, our team would put these things in, they would quietly sell out. We were doing 40 and 50% increases every month. And then we started to get the attention of the marketing team.
Like, what's quietly? Like when you put a number beside quietly?
Well, the year I started, we added $20 million to the business.
So that's, yeah.
And without really much interference or involvement. But when we start to add these big numbers, then you have more meetings. How can we support you?
Yeah.
Let's get strategic about this.
Yeah.
What other programs are in the pipeline? We always had stuff in the pipeline. It's like, well, working on the perfect fit panty. And because I was the woman in all the executives were men, I'd start talking about these things, and it was so uncomfortable that the men had to tune out anyways. And then they just let me do what I'd want to do, because she's given us numbers.
Yep.
It's weird what she's saying.
Mm-hmm.
And then the first year, the perfect fit panty, we sold 1 million units. And then it was like, just let her do whatever she wants to do. It's innovation driven.
Yep.
Women are loving it. More women are coming to the store. Men's is benefiting because they want to come and see the next latest coolest thing, and they're buying more stuff for their husbands.
Yeah,
it's magic.
Wild. So, and I don't remember the, you know, I'm a marketing person, so when I'm thinking about you telling this story, and I'm trying to remember like how things switched, whether it was on TV or whether it was on social or whether it was on in their print material.
It was print and TV.
And was it just like adding two more pages to the flyer?
Yes, that's exactly it.
Yeah.
You'd earn your pages because you had to do a certain dollar amount in a quarter of a page.
Yeah.
And if you could do that, it was in their best interest to give you a bit more. And they did have a strategic plan to grow the women's business. So I was well supported.
Yeah.
So as we proved ourselves out and had a strategic plan about what we wanted to go do and it fit with the overarching strategic plan of the company, mm-hmm. we just kept earning our way. Mm-hmm. More space in stores, more space in flyers.
Mm-hmm. And then just the numbers followed it.
The numbers followed. Mm. It's like a crazy ride. We had whiplash.
How long was that adventure?
I was there 8 years.
8 years. Okay.
But The original strategic plan after a year being there, when I set the plan on what we wanted to do.
Were you looking at like 8 years out when you were making this plan? Or
5 years out. It was always a five-year plan.
And what does it actually mean? Like you play at such a wild business level. I'm very curious. You're brand new to a new job, mm-hmm. new business, and you just sit there and you set a five-year plan. What did it actually mean? Like what did you say was going to happen within 5 years?
We're going to get to top five women's market share in the country, and we're going to get to $250 million of annual revenue.
Like, to even write that down and, like, say it out loud, like, I'm sure it's based a lot on data. But you're just swinging? Like, you see an opportunity and you're...
Remember, I have also come from Gucci and Ralph Lauren, so $250 million... didn't seem like so crazy, but apparently it did seem crazy at the time when I was saying it, except for the guys at Marks that were running it, the CEO, he had a brilliant way of looking at opportunity and I learned a ton from him. Mm. And it was find problems you want to solve in an innovative way, build the brands and look at the size of the markets. Like just Lara, look at the just size of the women's denim market in Canada, who's doing the business, how you're going to steal share. Mm-hmm. And what percentage of that market do you want to own? So if women's denim was 500 million, we were going to own 5%. At Marks, the store count and the flyers, you could fall out of bed drunk and do 5% share of the denim market if you just did half a few things right.
Mm-hmm.
So the culture, the environment of strategic planning, how I was taught to strategic plan and then just go execute, it wasn't really that hard.
Hmm. Wild. So 8 years. Mm-hmm. What was the, I don't know, I never asked this question, but was there like your favorite moment? Was there a moment you're like, holy hell, this is actually happening? Or was it just
as we were building it?
Yeah, or even like building it when you got to your goal, like you get to, and also right beside that question is like, once you get to where you want to be, are you then focused on the next thing? And the next thing could be a different company or a different problem.
It was always the next thing. I never stopped to realize what had been accomplished. It's the worst thing about me as a leader. We don't celebrate enough the big wins in the moment. It's always, did we leave money on the table? What could we have done better? How are we going to make that the next year even better than that? Which isn't great. I've really had to like soften my management skills over time, but it was always the next thing.
So even like when I asked the question, like if you had like the moment, your favorite moment, you don't, because you're just moving forward.
Yeah.
Hmm. So where are we after Marks? Where do you go?
So at Marks, in one of the executive meetings, I do remember talking about my desire because, again, I've got these women, these invaluable women in our customer advisory panels who were solving problems. And one of the problems was sweating at night and hot flashes. And the demographic was 45 to 55 year old women. And so wanting to build intimates and pajamas that would have technology that would eradicate the moisture and help them sleep better.
Yep.
And I think that was the last straw in the management groups that talking about night sweats and the guys are like, that's it. We can't hear about this night sweat grossness.
So yes. Marks is like, we don't really need to go there.
Yes. And I knew it was that was the next massive thing. And around exactly the same time was when my sister got diagnosed with breast cancer.
Yep.
And remember, I wake up in service of wanting to help women. We weren't.
Like, when you say that, is it, it's just your thing. And you've known that for a long time. Since
that
moment.
The customer.
Yeah. And right there, you're just like, this is what I do. Because even to be able to say that is just it's a freeing statement.
It's a freeing statement. And in another life, or did I feel that I should have been in med school to actually make a difference with people and cure, like help people in a real health medical way?
Yeah.
So maybe it was, I didn't do that. So the next best thing is figuring out how to help them feel better easily with apparel choices.
Yeah.
But I love waking up in service of women, and I was craving something more purposeful because we were bought by Canadian Tire.
Right.
It was shareholder value.
Yep.
It was less entrepreneurial and nimble. It got more corporate, and it was really time for me to do my own thing.
And you had enough data. You had enough data and experience.
Yes.
With everything, whether it's like sourcing material, all of it. You just had all your information. You were ready to go.
I knew the demand. How to do it.
So how many years from Gucci to the day you started your own business, how long was that? Ish.
Call it like 18-ish.
Okay. So like
a good amount of time.
Yeah. All right.
Yes.
So then you knew that it was your time and walked away?
For sure.
Okay.
In the moment, it was my sister was battling chemo and radiation, fighting for her life, and she was sweating every night and she couldn't get a good night's sleep. Yep.
And your, like the research group, they were kind of saying that this is a need too?
They were saying it was a need.
And then all of a sudden your family, your sister's like, and then you're, okay, this is.
Nobody was doing night sweat pajamas that could be substantiated in labs that it actually worked, that didn't look like granny jams. And my sister was 39. There was all the things. Like, this is a massive opportunity. Marks, it's a massive opportunity. So, but for me, it was so personal. She wasn't sleeping. How many women are suffering with cancer who can't sleep because they're sweating? That became the first problem to solve. And it wasn't even so much about, I'm going to create this big business. Let's just start with that and see how we can help her.
So take the leap. Did you know exactly order of operations and what had to happen?
Basically, it starts with building a better mousetrap. So what is the product? What's the fabric? What are the objective measures in moisture management we want to achieve? Because that's the world I lived. And how do we make it beautiful? So it's just the research. What's out there? What's beautiful? Combining these things, spending a lot of time at the fabric mill in Thailand with these like PhD level fabric engineers who were just in, who I'd worked with for 15 years.
You know.
And they knew what I liked and was trying to do, and they bought into the idea and just spent weeks. So it turned into 2 years before we had the fabric right.
No way. Did you think it was going to take that long?
No. But I didn't have an army of people anymore, remember? I was on my own doing all the things to start a business.
Yeah. And was that comfortable for you?
Yes and no. Like it took a while because I had so many, if I just had an idea, there was always someone that could just go out and do it, execute it. So when you're doing all the things, including your bookkeeping and including figuring out what sign to show at a trade show at midnight, the night before the trade show, because you forgot a sign, like those are all humbling experiences as a new business owner, entrepreneur, bootstrapping the heck out of everything. But I knew no matter what, had to get the product right, the best in class, set the standards so high on our performance. And had a lot of skepticism, people around me. Like my one partner initially was supportive of, was always like, are you overbuilding it, Lara? Will people pay for this?
Did you ever question that?
Every now and then.
Just when somebody brought it up or just when you were having a quiet moment to yourself, you're like, am I doing this the right way?
No, it's usually when someone I really respected brought it up. Because I always had such smart people around me, like really great advisors who I could pick up the phone and say, tell me how to think about this differently or challenge my thinking.
And so, but those little moments were short?
They were short because it sounds like ego, and it wasn't about that because it was trying to help women. I really wanted to build the Ferrari. If somewhere down the road we needed a Toyota version, I would cross that bridge. But to give women relief, the fabric is really expensive. And I wanted to make it beautiful, timeless, and elegant. And amazing fit pattern engineering. So I did want to try it my way to start. You could always take build out. You could always reduce something, but you can't launch a Toyota and then say you want to sell a Ferrari the next season. That doesn't work that way.
So building the Ferrari.
Built the Ferrari.
Took time.
Time and money.
Money.
Yeah.
So what year did you start?
2012. I left Marks to start the R&D of the fabric and the brand.
It's been a decade.
Yeah. We celebrated our 10-year anniversary in October of incorporation. Yeah.
Oh, wild.
Yeah.
So 2 years to build it out.
Yeah.
You kind of doing your own, doing everything. Yes. And what kind of what happens after 2 years? Like, where's your effort go?
We are in market on our website. We chose to do wholesale boutiques first because I do love the retail experience. I do love store owner operators being so close to the brand to give us feedback, and yeah. they're face to face with their customers. You don't get that direct to consumer. So we were started in 10 stores, wholesale
locally
boutiques.
Or across Canada? Where'd you
across
do?
Canada, okay. Quite a few local.
People you knew?
No.
You put together your, like, here's your pitch, and you went after people that you wanted to work with?
Hired some contract sales reps who already had the network of boutiques.
Yeah.
And then they just slowly got us into stores in 2014.
People just, they would take the products to the stores and people just start carrying the lines?
At shows, I would give a lot of free samples away at the beginning because there's always a menopausal woman somewhere in someone's network that owns a store.
Yeah.
And as soon as they would wear it and realize how comfortable and it would work and they would sleep better, that was always the silver bullet.
And were you did hustle around all the different trade shows and stuff?
Yes.
And just like horrible.
Humbling, horrible.
They're the worst.
Unless
you're built to just... And you're wired that way to handle those situations, I think they're the worst.
I'm not a salesperson. It's horrible being in that environment, trying to educate people on technology and why this is better than the next 85 pajama brands are going to see at the trade show. And it was a hard sell at first because it is a technical story. It's a health story as much as anything. And it was really hard. People were skeptical.
Yeah. And do you think trade shows, like, you can't – it's not the – well, maybe it is – it's not the – I don't think it's the right environment to tell your story, that kind of story.
No.
Because people are cruising around these aisles and whatever. They're just overwhelmed by...
Totally overwhelmed.
Too much information.
And the shiny thing.
Yeah.
With the biggest booth, with the right kind of...
Yeah, whoever's behind
lights.
The booth. Yeah. Could be the price, could be whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't ideal.
So did the tour. And then what's the growth look like from like 14 till now? Like, what do you...
I mean, we've doubled the business every year.
Yep.
There was moments in time. In 2016, we were in Oprah magazine. And then that just became a different credibility level in terms of the wholesale community, in terms of our website being able to market. When you buy the Google AdWords, Oprah's favorite things, that did a lot for our business.
How did you end up getting with Oprah?
Like, I have a very close friend who's a publicist in Toronto, and she always, like, she looked at our brand as pro bono because she just, every client pays her a zillion dollars and we could never, but she loves us and me and our story, and she'd just send out these things every now and then. And then we would get these massive, the media liked the story.
Well, how do you not?
Helping technical, helping women, it actually works.
Yeah. Was your story out there? Like, how many people know that the moment at, you know, selling that dress to that woman was your, like, defining, like, your moment of what you're going to do? How many people know that?
Well, probably just you until other people hear it.
Yeah. Which, you know, as you're telling stories and when, you know, as a publicist is selling a story, like, I can't imagine. Like, if you had all that, if that was part of the story of this whole brand, it'd be ridiculous what happens.
Probably, but people still, and you know the business, marketing and PR better than me.
I don't know. I know. Well, I know where I stand. I know my audience, and I know where I'm at right now.
It's often the next newest, coolest thing in the world of media. And by the way, media is all pay for play now, so it's totally. Just a very different story.
So when you get featured in Oprah's Mag, do you know that's just a blip in time? Are you like, holy hell, my business, I'm the real deal. I should be here. Or do you know it's just a moment in time and you're moving forward?
It's always moving forward. But what we loved at the time was that got more women's eyeballs on our brand to help more women. And women will share the stories with their network on if something helps them.
Yeah.
So it was all about reach at that point still. And that gave us a huge reach and credibility.
Mm-hmm.
But then it was just snowballed. It was Today Show 3 times and Fox News and Yahoo and Real Simple.
Like, are you on those shows or what are they doing?
Not the big US ones, but a lot of, you know, Amanda Lang at the time. Like, it was a lot of interviews at the time.
Yeah.
And that turned into the Canadian TV Home Shopping Network of, like, live selling. The menopause lady again. That's, oh my God, that'll be on my tombstone.
Were you prepared to be the voice and the face and do everything?
I resisted it every day.
Because working in all those corporate gigs, you know, you didn't have to like.
No, you can hide behind.
Yeah, but behind a big logo, a big corporation.
Yeah.
So when you turned all this on, did you know that you were going to do it and you're fighting it, or you just were just like, nah?
I fight it to this day. Mm. But Jill, my publicist in Toronto, and the way you describe people telling the story, and even now people are connecting more with the story and the person, and that does matter to people how they run their business. So I've let it go to a certain extent, but to talk about the technology and the brand, to be on QVC, speaking to zillions of women, it has to be me.
Yeah, for sure.
For to talk about how it works and how it benefits you.
Yeah, because there's something to be said for the person that came up with the idea and how close, why it was so such a passion project for you.
Like
you can't, you can't pawn that off on your whatever, COO, your marketing person, whoever you have. Like, it's just, it's your story to tell.
It's my sister. That's how it changed me. Learning the women that are suffering in silence. That's not okay. There's things we can do.
Yeah. So running, and I know nothing about this area, obviously, but like every year, are you innovating? Are you, is it always changing something, or are you kind of building a brand? And if you are building a brand, I'd love to know how you do that every year and how that changes.
I had a 4-year stint with an exclusive licensee that took over the operating of the business and the selling of the business. And I thought it was our ability to scale, to get in front of more stores. They had a massive 500 networks of 500 boutiques in the U.S. selling lingerie, and we could just fold into that sales network. So it seemed like a way to go from X to Y really quickly in volume.
Yep.
But they never bought into innovation. They never bought into solving the problem of sleep in an innovative, luxury, beautiful way. And that stifled my ability to innovate and create and deal with a customer face to face. And it was the four worst years of my career. I couldn't innovate.
From like corporate to owning your own thing.
Four worst years of my life, because so much of my life is wrapped up in business, helping women, innovating, doing the next thing, building a brand that started to get taken away from me. So
just for numbers.
Driving revenue.
Did they do that?
Yeah, a little bit.
But so they drove revenue, but kind of
in their way, which was wholesale, not direct to consumer. They didn't have a website for their own brands. It was all the wholesale model.
Gotcha.
Mom and pop boutiques.
Yep.
That was their thing.
Okay.
So it was very short-sighted and the worst career mistake of my life for sure.
And it doesn't sound like you make many.
Oh, zillions. But like, yeah, that was like a doozy one.
That one.
Yeah. And then they tried to steal the company from me.
So what does that, like, what does that actually mean?
That means getting a phone call that, no word of a lie, we are taking your company. This is, think of it as a hostile takeover. Did you read clause in small print on page 62 of our license agreement that we can trigger the shotgun clause? You have 28 days to come up with whatever millions to buy out the inventory, or we're suing your company.
Wow.
That was in the heat of COVID.
No way.
Yeah, it was just, well, as it was last June, 2021, June 8th, 2021.
Wow.
And I am a handshake type of girl. I did have a lawyer look. I have lawyers, but I look someone in the eyes and I felt like this was my partner and we were going to grow together. And then he tried to steal the company.
Wow. And the shotgun clause, if I understand it correctly, they offer you a number and then you have to turn around and buy it for that number.
Yes.
Or walk.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I went a bit insane because it was a breach of trust.
Yep.
It was, I've built this from nothing. Mm. You maniac. No one's taking my company. No one.
Yeah.
Lawyers, money was thrown at this.
Yep.
And I fought off, took lots of months and money, but fought it off and assumed control of the business January of this year.
Awesome. And so that's 10 months.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, so now what does it feel like?
I feel
you're back.
80 pounds lighter, 40 years younger, just because I can innovate again. And in the background, I think I knew I'd have to figure out how to get out of this relationship because in the background, I was developing the technology for the sheets quietly by myself. The technology for our anti-aging fabric quietly by myself. So that I knew when the time came, I'd be ready to get these things out in the way that we do, which is the building of the brand, which is solving problems for people and women in particular.
It's so brilliant. Like, so when you...
You know what, Jeff? It's not even brilliant. It's what patterns and data and reading people and luck and timing and surrounding yourself with smart people.
Which... I agree with all those.
Yeah.
But then it just like to make something work, to have all those variables in place, it's just almost shouldn't happen. And when it does happen, it's super, super rare.
Yes.
Which. But do you give that any thought, though? Like when you're making these crazy deals, like they're big numbers, you're innovating. I don't know what it takes to come up with a new sheet idea. I don't know what kind of money and time that takes. I'm sure it's a lot.
Yeah.
And you just trust that you're doing the right thing?
Right, because I've seen it enough now.
Yeah.
I started in Marks in 2004.
Yeah.
I know if you build something better than the rest, prove that it's better than the rest, not just by saying it, make it look beautiful and tell the right people in the right way, it works every time.
Mm. Do you ever get, this is me being like tactical, do you ever think about how you're going to market it, how you're going to build the brand? Tactically about like which levers you're going to pull. Like, do I have to be at this trade show? Do I have to get on this website? Do I need to build this kind of website? Is that your sweet spot?
It's not really my sweet spot.
And you don't need it, right? Like,
we do.
You need it, but it's down the road.
If we were doing it better, our sales would be better. I always, you know, we can do anything we want, we can't do everything. And it comes down to time and money and the resources we have. We're a small team. We're raising money.
Raising money to just keep...
Growth. Put the gas in the tank so we can grow fast.
Right.
Hire the people.
To do the
marketing.
Things.
To do the things. Our team is 2.5 people full time. And then a ton of fractionals and contractors and friends and favors and... who believe in the story and know it's going to get to 100 million. So when they get their equity, their sweat equity, it's going to be really meaningful someday.
Is that your goal?
100 million for sure is kind of easy in the next 4 to 5 years.
With you back at the helm, doing your thing.
Doing the thing.
Innovating,
telling people, showing people, and then getting people out there to sell it, getting the right marketers to put enough eyeballs at the brand.
Yep.
And then the right people on the street selling it at the trade shows.
Does it ever, like when you say 100 million is easy, I know you're saying like tongue in cheek, but like it's a real number.
It's a real number, but when you know the size of the prize, when you know 37 million adults in North America sleep hot and sweat overnight and it disrupts their sleep, you extrapolate that to if we only got 5% of those 37 million, that's $850 million of annual revenue. We don't need 5% of just North Americans. Mm-hmm. That's before we go Europe, mm-hmm. Southeast Asia, all over the place. So it's what I learned at Marks on how to identify market opportunity, the addressable market, and the size of the prize.
Mm. So it all makes sense.
Like it's just, because that's like the numbers.
Yeah, it's right
there.
The
data,
When you decided to spin up your own company, was it data-driven first? Did you do all the research first to see if it was viable? Or were you so passionate about helping women and then your sister getting sick that you're just, I'm doing this and I'll figure out the analytics after?
There's a little bit about doing and learning as you go, and I now detest the word pivot, but back in the day, go where the money is.
As in,
at the beginning.
Okay.
So after you develop the product that you're happy with, the performance, it looks great, you're proud of the thing you created, then you still have to drive sales. Then it's about the money. So I did have an understanding of the size of the market at the time, but it was so personal and emotional around my sister. If you build this great thing and then women will benefit, that's always kind of been the secret sauce.
Mm. So cool. Like my mind's just like kind of fried because I'm thinking about what you've done and all the lessons I can learn. So this is, it's really, really, really cool. So in the last 10 months, what's been the biggest shift for you? Just releasing these ideas that you've been working on and bringing those to market or is it, did you start doing something different with the original brand?
When I was fighting off the hostile takeover and being able to sell the first investor to put money in, I had to get very clear on our strategic plan and just make that the research and the strategic plan and the investor deck was so locked. But remember, I'd just come off someone trying to steal the company. So my trust level was zero.
Yeah, you didn't want anybody around you.
I don't trust any of you. You're all going to steal something. Mm-hmm. So the biggest shift for me is I have amazing people in my life. And you know Shane, our fractional CFO, Matt, my friend Jill. I've got people now that I can totally relinquish and trust.
Yeah.
And that I didn't know if I'd ever get back. So when you have people in the right jobs and let them do their job, I can do what will serve the company best, which is the customer experience, figuring out what problem to solve, innovative, and bringing the things to market. Mm. Let me just focus on that. And there'll be people in ops and finance and investor relations, supply chain.
Yeah. Can you see that team being built out?
Oh, yes. I see it. It's so clear.
Mm-hmm. Is it written out or do you see the vision in your head?
I mean, it's written out from the standpoint of you know the roles and what they need to do.
Yep.
But as someone comes into your life and the business who can offer something slightly different, you always morph to what serves the person the best and their skills and what they love to do. Because if people love to do something, are great at it, they'll perform best for the company. So you adjust the job description for them.
Mm-hmm. So crazy. Like, I don't – it's such a – it's refreshing for me to hear, you know, like from a business person like you to listen to how you think and how you operate is really cool.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it's just, it's because some people think it's all done in books, you know, some people and other people, it's a mix of intuition and analytics. And so, yeah, it's always cool to hear from, especially when someone from like you chasing 100 million, like this isn't a little kid store. So it's really cool. This has been really fun. I end the show by asking one question.
Yes.
When I say Calgary, where does your head go?
Stampede.
Really?
I never would participate in Stampede. I'm an introvert, antisocial person, so it was kind of like gross.
Yep.
But I had a blast this year. I get it.
And do you think this was the first year you actually could say you enjoyed it?
That I actually participated in anything.
Like going out, you mean?
Or just going out. Going to events.
Yep.
My son was horrified. He's like, what's going on, Mom? Are you having a midlife crisis because you're like getting dressed up and going out to Stampede events? You thought he'd have to have an intervention.
Wild.
But it was a Stampede.
you just surprised yourself that it was that kind of, there's that energy or there was something, like it was a positive thing for our city.
It's a great thing for the city.
Yep.
I was open to it. And I think at my stage of working so hard and I'm open to fun now and you need a balance. And I think I've had X amount of adult years, so serious reading for fun. A pastime is reading annual reports. That's not a fun person. So I have amazing, amazing friends and amazing man in my life that are inspiring me to have these fun moments. And I'm really enjoying it.
Cool. Will you, next Stampede, are you going to like host your own party?
Likely.
Have you booked your spot yet?
No. Is that the things I need to do and think about?
Probably.
What's wrong with this?
Well, this place is rad. I guess you can throw some hay bales up here. Yes. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks. This was awesome, Jeff.
This was really cool. I'm glad Shane did the intro.
Me too.
And again, just like this podcast is built on people in the city doing wild things. So it's been a really cool story to hear.
Thanks for letting me tell it.
Thank you.